Democracy in Decline, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Americans want to live in a democracy, right? Well,
once you get to younger people, born in 1980 or later, less than one-third say it's essential to them to live in a democracy. And you see really strikingly similar trends around the world.
Also, job retraining was supposed to help American workers survive the decline of manufacturing, but many found no jobs to match their new skills. Or, as one worker puts it,
what good is a donut if you don't have coffee to dunk it in?
Plus, a Cuban dissident on whether to mourn Castro's death or celebrate it.
Everybody has the right to feel what they feel. Every Cuban now, the lesson is to know how to accept everybody's feeling without judging.
That's all ahead today on The World. Another day, another tweet storm from the president-elect. Yesterday, it was about illegal voting, no evidence to the claim. Today, it's flag burning, which Donald Trump tweeted ought to be punished with jail time or maybe a loss of citizenship. The Supreme Court might refer Trump to the First Amendment on that one. It appears that facts don't always matter to him, nor it seems do freedom of expression and other democratic norms. Even more concerning, perhaps, Trump's kind of rhetoric is popular with a lot of people who don't seem to care that much about this stuff either, and not just here in the United States. So what is going on with democracy? Maybe it isn't that popular anymore. Yasha Monk is a professor of government at Harvard, and for several years now, he's been measuring the health of democracies around the world.
For the last 20 or 30 years, there's been all kinds of worrying signs. Voter participation has gone down in a lot of countries. People are less and less satisfied with particular governments. They no longer trust politicians. Approval ratings for Congress, parliaments, and so on are very, very low. And so a couple of years ago, I started thinking, well, what if we should take these warning signs seriously? How can we figure out whether people are just getting more critical, more demanding of a political system, or whether they actually are disenchanted with democracy in a deep way? And so I started looking at three measures of what I call regime legitimacy. The first is simply, how important is it to people to live in a democracy? The second is, are they open to authoritarian alternatives, to democratic rule, like, say, having the army rule? And the third is whether you see anti-system parties, movements, politicians who really don't like the democratic system, who violate its core norms, gain a lot of power. And across each of these three dimensions, the warning signs have been flashing red.
Right. And you're talking about democracies, not just the United States, but all over the world, right? So what is the big trend?
Right. So, for example, when we look at is it important to people to live in a democracy, it's very clear across the board that young people are disenchanted, that it's not as important to them. So, for example, looking at the United States, people born in the 1930s and 1940s asked on a scale of 1 to 10 how important it is to them to live in a democracy. Over two-thirds say 10 out of 10, absolutely essential. Once you get to younger people born in 1980 or later, millennials, less than one-third say it's essential to them to live in a democracy. And you see really strikingly similar trends in Great Britain, in France, in New Zealand, lots of places around the world.
Yeah, and what about the warning signs here in the United States? What do you see here in this country? I mean, are younger people ready to, like in Venezuela or in Egypt, ready to hand things over to a military ruler?
I mean, obviously, I don't think that we can compare the United States today to Venezuela or Egypt in a straightforward way. Yeah. But yes, the number of people who are open to authoritarian rule has really gone up in the United States. Among all people, 1 in 16 Americans in 1995 said that army rule is a good system of government. By 2015, it was 1 in 6. And when you look at only young and affluent people, it's actually gone up from 6 to 36%. That's a six-fold increase over the course of 20 years. But the most worrying sign in the United States is simply the complete erosion of democratic norms in the political system. Political scientists have believed that democracies are stable when democracy is the only game in town, when everybody who matters accepts democratic norms. And now we have a president-elect who has violated democratic norms at every turn of a debate, of a campaign, who has threatened to jail his political opponent, who has threatened not to accept the outcome of the election. And you see him say today, not just that people who burn the American flag should be punished, but that they should have the citizenship revoked from them. All of these are authoritarian behaviors and the fact that the president-elect is able to engage in them and that he hasn't been roundly denounced for it by members of his own party are real signs of an erosion of democratic norms here in the United States.
Do you believe that white people who feel threatened by different identities are willing to give up a bit of democracy to get, you know, to reassert some personal power?
Right. I think here it's important to distinguish between democracy and liberal democracy. Right. They don't want to give up on democracy in the sense that they want the army to rule. But they have a vision of democracy that is very hierarchical, that gets rid of independent power centers that somehow impede the expression of a popular will, and that's deeply disdainful of minority rights and human rights. So when you look at what Poland or Hungary or Turkey are headed towards, it's not a matter of them rebelling against democracy as such. It's a matter of them wanting to give an illiberal cast to democracy. So they do want to have elections. They do want to be able to vote for a populist leader who claims to speak for the people, to express the popular will in his person. But then they also want to give this leader the right to disregard the interests and the rights of minorities, to undermine independent institutions like courts, to use things like the Internal Revenue Service or the Department of Justice in order to serve his political goals. So what we're entering is an era in which the regime form we've known, liberal democracy, but has two constituent elements, is breaking apart. And we're increasingly seeing the rise of illiberal democracy or democracy without rights taking its place.
Yasha Monk, professor of government at Harvard on a Train to New York. Thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you so much.
This is also an era of global trade when jobs are seen to be movable. So let's say you're a blue-collar worker in Michigan or Ohio or Indiana. You've worked for the same company your whole life. You're 40, maybe 50. Then your factory closes and those jobs are moved to Mexico or China or wherever. What do you do? Well, the election of 2016 was partly about that question. Donald Trump said he'd bring the jobs back. Hillary Clinton argued for tens of billions of dollars to retrain laid-off workers. The World's Jason Margolis explored this issue in Indiana and Pennsylvania.
3 decades ago, American steel mills were shutting down and tens of thousands of workers were losing their jobs. So the Steelworkers Union and steel companies came up with an idea. Establish centers to teach classes and skills development to workers. You know, create a backup plan.
I'm having troubles with these fitting in here.
Yeah, to make a good brace connection, it's all about the preparation, so shine up the copper.
Today, Travis Kepin is taking an HVAC course in Burns Harbor, Indiana. He's learning how to repair cooling and heating systems. By day, he works across the street at the local steel mill. Kepin says he's taking this course after his shift because he likes learning and also because he's worried about his job.
When I actually got hired in over here, it was one of my big concerns. My family's worked at this mill for generations now, and, you know, my family went through some hard times, so I was worried about it, definitely.
His teacher, Dennis Matney, knows firsthand that worry is justified. He used to work at the nearby mill.
21 and a half years there, they let me go. I went to U.S. Steel Gary Works, spent a month and a half there. I like to say that's a good length of time for a U.S. Steel career. Then I went to the old Bethlehem plant.
At that third steel job, Matney found out about career development courses, studied HVAC, and eventually became an instructor. The classes are free. The steel industry funds the Institute for Career Development, which has 57 locations nationwide. They offer a range of courses from paralegal studies to locksmithing to pharmacy technician training. The 64-week HVAC class provides certification to work in the field.
Always a good time to get an HVAC. I think it's the Bureau of Labor Statistics had projected an increase of 14% as far as heating and air conditioning jobs from the years 2014 to 2024. I know that because I researched that, because I put that into the flyer for the class.
HVAC might be in demand, but steel workers would take a hit with that career transition.
It's tough to replicate a mill salary because a lot of guys make six figures because they live out there.
Translation, they work a lot of overtime. But if there's no job, there's no income at all. Hillary Clinton had wanted to invest heavily in job retraining, $30 billion for struggling communities. When I was in western Pennsylvania last summer in hollowed-out manufacturing towns, I brought up that idea.
We've seen that out of the Democrat playbook for the last 40 years.
That's Steve Toprani, a Republican and former district attorney for Washington County, just south of Pittsburgh. He says job retraining is fine in theory, but manufacturing workers often get pushed out of the middle class, working in service sector jobs.
What does that cause? That causes additional frustration. It causes additional tax on our system, and it's not solving the problem.
It wasn't just Republicans dismissing Clinton's proposal. Democrat Nancy Horvath used to work in a factory. Now she's a meter maid in Manesson, Pennsylvania. She's seen laid-off coworkers invest time and sweat in career retraining, but there were no jobs in the end.
What good is a donut if you don't have coffee to dunk it in?
This year, she went with Trump and his promise to bring back the old jobs, and quick.
I'm hopeful. No one's mentioned bringing back any manufacturing until he did. And this area, it's sad. It's sad to remember what it was when we were kids growing up and fighting people on the sidewalk. It was so crowded, and now there's nothing here.
This nostalgia and skepticism about retraining programs is understandable, but people need to get past it, says Stephen Hertzenberg, the executive director of the liberal-leaning Keystone Research Center in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. He says the Rust Belt needs a new economic future, one that starts with money for job retraining.
But it's only very much the beginning, and we definitely think part of it is being creative about if you're going to create renewable energy jobs or you're going to have more solar collective farms. You got to try to push more of that, and it's going to take time for people to be convinced that there is an alternative to going back to more coal.
Donald Trump needs to be sold on that narrative, too. Maybe he can bring back coal jobs. Maybe he can't. Market economics say it's unlikely as natural gas prices keep falling and push out coal. Also, climate scientists warn investing in more coal would have disastrous implications for climate change. Back in Indiana, former steelworker turned HVAC instructor Dennis Matney says coal workers and everybody in manufacturing should invest some time in a backup plan.
I think that you can resist change all you like, but it's going to happen regardless. I mean, you might as well get with the program.
That's a tough message to take, though, that life as you know it is ending. And as Hillary Clinton learned the hard way, not one that a lot of voters wanted to hear. For The World, Jason Margolis, Burns Harbor, Indiana.
A short note before we take a break. In the U.S., campaigns to fight drunk driving often sound like this.
When friends don't stop friends from drinking and driving.
Yeah, it's effective. But in a small town on Prince Edward Island in Canada, police are turning their Don't Drink and Drive campaign up to 11 with this. Yes, Nickelback, the dark, high-octane Canadian rock band everyone loves to hate. Police in the town of Kensington are using the band's album Silver Side Up as a deterrent to drunk drivers. Cops are threatening that anyone picked up for drunk driving will have to sit in the cruiser and listen to the entire Nickelback album on cassette. I think for a lot of people, even Canadians, that wouldn't just deter drunk driving, it might count as torture. Constable Rob Hartland told the CBC that he was just trying to inject a little humor into the very serious matter of drinking and driving. He also grudgingly admitted that he actually likes a few of Nickelback's songs. Poor Nickelback, Hartland added. They take the brunt of a nation's joke, and I'm sure they're crying all the way to the bank. Coming up, a Cuban performance artist wants to return to the island and open a microphone so all Cubans can talk. Is it possible now? She'll tell us what she thinks later here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. A soccer fairy tale ended in tragedy last night in Colombia. A team from Brazil was on its way to the city of Medellin for what fans were already calling the biggest game in the club's history. But now that game will not take place after the team's plane crashed into the mountains south of Medellin. More than 70 people were killed, including most of the players on board. But a few of those on board somehow survived. The team involved was Chapecoense from a small city in southern Brazil. The tragedy has shocked not just Brazilians, but the entire soccer world. My BBC colleague Tim Vickery is in Rio de Janeiro. So this is a tragedy for soccer and soccer fans, but especially families of the players and fans of this town, Chapeco. What are you hearing from there, Tim?
Well, I mean, it's heartbreaking scenes, really. And the news broke very, very early in the wee small hours here in Brazil. This wonderful fairy tale of a team who only got into Brazil's fourth division in 2009 and have kept rising. This wonderful fairy tale has been interrupted in a most brutal and terrible manner.
What did it take Chapecoense to get to the finals? I mean, this is what's been called the biggest game in its history that now will not be.
Absolutely no doubt about this. This is a small town team with very little tradition and even less glamour, who have achieved what no other Brazilian team, even the Giants, have been able to achieve for the last 3 years, to make it through to the final of a continental tournament. So from not even being in the first four divisions to reaching the final, it's a remarkable fairy tale. But unfortunately now, this latest grim twist has meant that the adventure of Chapecoense is now leaving a continent astonished and a world astonished for very different reasons.
I mean, the people in Chapeco must be shattered on so many different levels.
Yes.
Condolences came in from Lionel Messi, Wayne Rooney, Neymar.
I think this is something that automatically touches the football community. And we have seen not just words, also some people prepared to make acts of solidarity, some clubs willing to give Chapecoense some players to help them rebuild. And some heartwarming stuff from Atlético Nacional of Medellín, who were to have been Chapecoense's opponents on Wednesday. First, it seems that at the time that the game was due to take place, Atlético Nacional will open the stadium doors and they're calling their fans to come to specially pay tribute to those who lost their lives. And they're also, there's talk coming, it seems, from the players of Atlético Nacional that they would like the trophy to be awarded to Chapecoense as a tribute to those who've died.
Oh, that's a great
but
tribute.
But also, in solid financial terms, it means that the club, Chapecoense, will be included in next year's the Copa Libertadores, which guarantees them revenue, which will be important in helping the club try to get back on its feet. I know that at this moment, those considerations are secondary. There are two main considerations. Number one is treating the six survivors who have sustained serious injuries. And number two is rescuing and identifying the bodies of those who have lost their lives. As well as being the biggest tragedy in Brazil's sporting history, it's also the biggest tragedy in journalistic history in Brazil, because amongst those who lost their lives were 21 journalists. So this goes way, way beyond just the football field.
Yeah, that's a somber footnote to end on. I'd rather end on this line from the Medellin team, Atlético Nacional, today when they asked CONMEBOL to give the Sudamericana Cup to Chapecoense. As far as we're concerned, they said, Chapecoense will forever be the champions of the Sudamericana Cup. Anyway, the BBC's Tim Vickery in Rio de Janeiro. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Here's another story out of Colombia, a very different one. If you look at a map of South America, you'll notice that Colombia and Venezuela are neighbors. And with Venezuela's economy now in free fall, many there are struggling with extreme shortages of food and medicine. So now Venezuelans are doing what Colombians did a lot at the height of their civil war. They're crossing the border looking for a better life. Luis Gaijo in the Colombian capital Bogota says you can really feel the Venezuelan presence now.
The first thing you notice are the restaurants. Driving around a friend's neighborhood, we spot five different Venezuelan places within three blocks.
There's a boom of restaurants that has areperas. 10 years ago, you have only one arepera in Bogotá. But nowadays, you have an arepera everywhere.
That's Gustavo Cruz, a Venezuelan who runs a restaurant here with his father. He's talking about arepas, a corn flatbread popular in both countries. Bogotá is awash in Venezuelan areperas, a testament to the recent influx of Venezuelan migrants and their visibility in the city's public life.
If you want to check the numbers of the Venezuelans, I mean, it's increased a lot.
By almost 40% between 2010 and 2015. And that's just those who came with legal papers. Many more have crossed the border and stayed. I went to check out a new trendy barbershop across the street from my apartment in Bogotá. The guy who cuts my hair is Gustavo Candiri. He's Venezuelan and arrived in Bogotá less than a year ago. The shop was noisy, so I asked him to step outside.
We had a critical health situation there because my wife had a high-risk pregnancy and the hospitals weren't equipped to treat her. There is no medicine because of the shortages Venezuela is going through. Doctors told me that they couldn't guarantee my wife's or the baby's life, and that was the biggest reason to leave the country.
Once in Colombia, his wife was able to get the medical treatment she needed. Their son was born healthy in a Bogota hospital last March. Candiri says he owns a small business back in Venezuela. Here in Colombia, he worked odd jobs until he got hired as a barber. He tells me it's hard to start all over. He says many Venezuelans are doing what he's done.
My country is going through a very sad time. The government is killing us with hunger.
He says Colombia has been good to him and his family, and he's grateful. But it used to be all the way around. In the 1970s and 80s, many Colombians fled violence and economic stagnation and headed to Venezuela, which was experiencing an oil boom. Up to 4 million Colombians made the move to Venezuela during that time. Now, that population flow has reversed. At the barbershop, I also speak with the owner, Camila Rincón. She says she's hired two Venezuelans to work at her shop.
Personalmente, a mí no me molesta. Son muy buenos trabajos.
I have no problem hiring Venezuelans. I think they come to do honest work.
She says it's hard to read in the news about what's happening in Venezuela these days. And she's happy to help out her neighbors.
And that's life. You never know how it's going to turn out. Today we do it for them, tomorrow they might do it for us.
I asked Camila if she thinks most Colombians feel the same way about the new wave of migrants coming from next door. She says she thinks so, at least for now.
Maybe if too many come, problems like unemployment might get worse. Maybe crime will go up. Things could get more complicated, but we can't generalize.
That's what I hear when I grab an Uber ride with Juan Camilo Diaz. He tells me Colombia has been invaded by Venezuelans.
Colombia está invadido de venezolanos.
But he's okay with that.
Pues llegó el momento de devolverles ese favor.
I think it's time for us to return the favor. When they had a solid economy, they received people from everywhere, and they helped many Colombians get ahead in life.
I ask him what if more Venezuelans start driving Uber cars and became his competition.
They have families to feed, too. It would be mean to not let them be my competitors. They have a right to work and eat.
For The World, Luis Gallo, Bogota, Colombia.
You're tuned to The World.
The World is brought to you by PRI, with help from TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. More at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman. A photographer set up a portrait stand on a pedestrian bridge in Guangzhou, China. His customers were from places like Nigeria, Mali, and Tanzania.
Unbeknownst to him, he was documenting this whole influx of people coming from the African continent.
Their story told in souvenir photos. That's ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. We were talking earlier on the show today about democracy, and what started us thinking about that was Donald Trump's tweet about burning the flag. He said there should be consequences for people who do that, like losing their citizenship. It's a First Amendment issue, though, freedom of speech. Maybe we shouldn't take that for granted now. People in Cuba certainly don't. There's a high price to pay there if you speak too freely. So with Fidel Castro gone now, what's going to change? Tanya Bruguera is a Cuban artist and dissident. She's now based here in the U.S. and would like to go back to Havana. But because she's a dissident, she's waiting a few weeks to see how things shake out. Cuban authorities have arrested her three times in recent years. Tanya Bruguera says Fidel's death has stirred up deep emotions for Cubans, and she thinks that each response needs to be respected.
I think the most important thing is that everybody has the right to feel what they feel. Mm. And every Cuban now, the lesson is to know how to accept everybody's feeling without judging.
The whole idea of what's going to change in terms of freedom of expression is a very personal one for you as an artist. Can you imagine, like right now, being on the island, and bringing Cubans together for a performance. Mm-hmm. And what sort of event would you invite them to? What would you want to say?
I think the piece I did where I tried to put the microphones so people could say what they wanted the country to be, you know, have for the first time the opportunity in public to bring all the different voices. And I think, unfortunately, this performance is still needed.
Has it happened? Did it ever happen?
Well, I try, and it brought me into a lot of trouble, and I was in jail several times, and for 8 months I couldn't go out of the country. So I think, yeah, that's the thing that needs still to be done.
So how do you think freedom of expression is going to open up in Cuba, or is it?
I don't think it's going to open up with Raul. Raul, unfortunately, is afraid of his own people. Raul is a president that's afraid of the Cubans.
What's he afraid of?
I think he has been in the shadows for too long. He's the number two for all his life, so it's hard to be number one. But secondly, I think he knows his limitations as a president. He was set up to be the transitional president, which is great, and everybody was very excited about it. But then we realized that all the changes, quote-unquote, that he made were done during the negotiation with the American government. As soon as the negotiation were resumed, all of these, quote-unquote, advances were resumed, and some of them were changed back to where it were before. So I think people understand that this is very theatrical moment, which is different from Fidel. Fidel was a more emotional, also manipulative, but in a smarter way.
When you talk about the Cuban people, talk a little bit more about Cuban youth and millennials, because there's a sense that they're quite apathetic. I mean, a lot of them want to leave the island, those who can. Those who were able to did already. Mm-hmm. How do they play into what happens next in Cuba?
We need somebody in power that is able to create an imaginary of the country that attracts the people who have thought it's a failed project.
And how does that person do that? And how is that person not going to be Raul Castro?
It's not going to be Raul because, for example, he opened up the idea of like, yes, Cubans can repatriate. So a lot of people got excited and repatriate in order to have businesses there or houses. And then they realized it was all theater again. You know, so when you have a country that is based in a script theater where you play no role, then there is no space for you to participate.
It's kind of interesting. I don't know how you feel, but it's kind of interesting that Fidel Castro's death comes on the heels of the election of Donald Trump. So one country opening up, maybe, while another is about to get more insular, maybe. What did young Cubans and the artists you know on the island make of the election of Donald Trump, and how do they think about that in terms of their own future?
I don't think only in Cuba, but I think everybody in the world is horrified. Everybody's freaking out. And in Cuba, also because I think Obama had a policy that really excited people in the island. Because, first of all, for the first time, the enemy was eliminated. Now we have, with Trump, a very strong enemy. And while I have to say that Obama should have been a little more strong on defending human rights in the island before he gave so much, I think his policy was correct. I have to say something. The most subversive video and the most subversive thing you could have in Havana was the circulation of Obama's speech when he was there. The government didn't want anybody to hear it.
Why not? What was he saying that was so provocative?
Obama didn't speak to Cubans as a president. He spoke to Cubans as a community organizer. Hmm. And he actually touched a lot of Cubans. You know, he actually made a lot of Cubans excited for the first time in a long time. And he actually made people think, yeah, I can make a change, small, medium, whatever, but I can make one change.
I mean, you say a lot of people in Cuba, all over the world, were horrified by the election of Donald Trump, but a lot of people weren't surprised, and a lot of people were not horrified. In fact, it fits perfectly into their worldview. I mean, whether it's in Russia or in India or in France or in England.
Or in Philippines.
Or in the Philippines.
Yes.
And I imagine there are a lot of Cuban Americans who voted for Donald Trump as well.
Yeah. Well, the Cuban Americans vote for Trump as group. And I was very disappointed, I have to say. They were willing to be looking at their problem first and only. They didn't see, I think, the big picture. And I'm not good at predictions, but I will predict that Trump, as soon as he sees a business opportunity, he will betray everybody, including the Cuban Americans.
Well, apparently he's already seeing business opportunities.
Of course.
President yet. I assume you'd like to go back to Cuba as soon as possible, but when will you go back?
And what will you do artistically? Three times.
Yeah.
And every time they wait for me in the airport, and I have around an hour and a half or 2 hour interrogation session, which I never understand why they're doing it, because I don't know what the goal of it is, other than making me think twice before I go back, or maybe feel uncomfortable to be back, and also when I leave.
As far as returning anytime soon, you still think?
Yes, I'm coming. Yeah. I'm going back in a few weeks.
We wish you great luck. Will you try and do a performance when you're back?
Yes.
Lovely to meet you. Thank you for coming in.
Nice seeing you. Thank you for having me.
Cuban artist and dissident Tania Bruguera. Guangzhou, China. It's a giant port city with a huge industrial base. Not surprising then that it attracts traders from all over the globe, including a large community of people from parts of Africa. Daniel Traub is a photographer and filmmaker who tells their story in a project he calls Little North Road. So who are these Africans in Guangzhou, Daniel?
Well, primarily they're from West Africa, but I came across people from all over the continent. You know, there's been a relationship between China and Africa for many decades, but over the last 15 years or so, it's kind of ramped up quite a bit.
Right. So what are these Africans, largely from West Africa, doing in Guangzhou? What do they do for a living?
Well, primarily they're traders. They're kind of an entrepreneurial class of people who come to China to buy Chinese goods. Guangzhou is the marketplace for all the goods that are produced in the Pearl River Delta. So they come to Guangzhou for short periods to buy goods to ship back to Africa.
Mm.
But there's also many people who have set up longer-term businesses, restaurants, barbershops, and all kinds of other things.
I mean, the portraits in this book called Little North Road, a lot of these emigres look really adjusted. They look like they belong in Guangzhou. Tell us what Little North Road is and this pedestrian bridge where a lot of these portraits were taken.
It's an incredibly dense and kind of chaotic neighborhood. You know, there's Africans, but there's also Middle Easterners. And also, it's very much a migrant community of Chinese migrants from all over the country. You have to traverse this bridge to get from one part of the neighborhood to the other. Because the neighborhood is so dense, there isn't really any kind of open spaces. So people use this pedestrian bridge as a kind of town square. So it was on this bridge that I came across a Chinese photographer named Wu Yongfu, who was making portraits of Africans, primarily, who are passing by on this bridge.
Right. I mean, your own involvement in this project is both as a photographer and kind of in a way as an archivist, because the photos in this book are mostly not yours. They were taken by two photographers, one you just mentioned, and another. Tell us how you met them and what you saw your role as being in this project.
You know, I was documenting this neighborhood, and I felt very much like an outsider. I wasn't really getting the kind of intimacy that I wanted. So I guess I was looking for, you know, I had my eye out for something. And so on this pedestrian bridge, I found this migrant worker, Wu Yongfu, who was making a living together with his wife by making these souvenir portraits of basically anyone who would hire him to make a portrait. But because this neighborhood is so many Africans, most of his clients were Africans. So I went up to him and introduced myself, and I looked at his photographs, and I became immediately fascinated by the breadth and range of what he was doing.
I'm looking at one photograph now of two young African women. They're in plaid shirts, one kind of green and white, the other kind of green and black. And they're almost in a dancing pose. It's at night on this bridge. Tell me about that photograph.
This is one of the photographs of Wu Yongfu. And what I realized was that unbeknownst to him, he was documenting this whole influx of people coming from the African continent and from the global south. When I saw his photographs, I realized that the bridge is kind of like a gateway for all these people. And he was, in a sense, making this index of all these people that were passing by. And he was also, because he was doing this purely to make a living, he would delete the photographs at the end of every day. So I...
What, just have space on like the flashcard or something?
Yeah, yeah. You know, he wasn't thinking of them in terms of having any other value other than as a way to make a living. So I ended up giving him a hard drive so that he could start to collect the photographs.
The people in the photographs, they're unnamed. Do they know their faces are being seen all over the globe?
No. You know, there was no way for me to find all these people to get their consent. But but my sense was that these pictures needed to be preserved because otherwise they're being erased every day.
Hmm. Do you think you managed to preserve in some way this moment of migration of Africans to China? And are these people in this book, are they in Guangzhou to stay?
Well, the population in Guangzhou of Africans has gotten smaller. So this project is a kind of document of a moment that has already changed or has already passed.
Daniel Traub's project, it's a book, it's a film, and an exhibition, is called Little North Road. Daniel, thanks very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you.
You can see some of the portraits of African emigres on that bridge in Guangzhou. Really remarkable photos. And they're at PRI.org. These days, when there's so much talk about building border walls and retreating from international cooperation, it's good to hear a story like this one. Belgium and Holland have just agreed to change a small portion of their mutual border, swapping some land in the process, all in a very friendly way, just because it made things easier. The border change along the River Meuse is pretty small, but the agreement is definitely worth talking about, especially since it began, bizarrely, with a headless corpse. Dan Bileski wrote about this for the New York Times.
This is a story with a rather gruesome beginning. Essentially, Belgium and the Netherlands, which have long had a historical rivalry, found themselves in this predicament where part of the Belgian border is on the Dutch side and part of the Dutch border is on the Belgian side. This is where the headless body comes in. Several years ago, a headless corpse was found by a couple hiking. And when they called the Belgian authorities said that it was in the Netherlands. And when they talked to the Netherlands, the Dutch authorities said that it was under Belgian jurisdiction.
So before we go any further, just describe this area where this border was kind of reestablished. I mean, we're talking the Low Countries here, Holland to the north, Belgium to the south. What does this area look like?
So the area is actually very picturesque. It's apparently a nature reserve, and it's essentially a patch of land that intersects a peninsula near the Netherlands. And what happened was that in 1961, the river in the area, which is called the Meuse, was reconfigured to aid navigation. And in so doing, three pieces of land were pushed to the wrong side of the river. And that's where the problems began.
Yeah, so before this headless corpse was found, how many people, Dutch and Belgians, who lived around this river in this area, did they know where the border even ran?
No. I mean, ironically, in a region where there have long been geopolitical and linguistic divisions and where borders really matter, this area was not particularly well known, and these patches of land were not at all inhabited. So this headless corpse seems to be the catalyst that put it under a spotlight.
Right. So one side couldn't investigate the other side. What agreement did the Dutch and Belgians eventually reach?
Well, the agreement they reached, which was signed yesterday with great fanfare in the Netherlands with the royals of both countries in attendance, the Belgians agreed to cede about 35 acres of land near the river in exchange for about 7 acres of land from the Dutch. So the amount of land involved is pretty infinitesimal in the global scheme of events.
Still, do you think it is a reminder to other nations that it is possible, even in 2016, to reshape borders without bullets?
I think in this Trumpian age when, the president-elect is talking about building a wall on the border with Mexico, you know, after decades in which we've had strife and bloody wars, including in the Balkans, more recently in Ukraine, it is a reminder that two historic rivals can make peace. But indeed, let's hope that headless bodies don't have to be the catalyst behind it.
The New York Times' Dan Bileski, thanks very much for telling us about this.
Thank you.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Politics isn't the only thing that can bring up deep-seated passions when talking about Cuba. Music can also do the same thing. And when those two are mixed together, well, things can get really intense. The Cuban band Los Van Van is one of those bands that inspire both. And to tell us about that, we're joined by Felix Contreras. He's a host of Alt Latino, a weekly podcast and radio show from NPR about Latino arts and culture. Felix, welcome to you.
Hey, Marco. Thanks for having me on the show, man.
So before we get to the big controversy around Los Van Van, tell us about the band itself.
Okay, Los Van Van is one of those bands that's both popular and musically innovative. Okay, that started in 1969 by bassist Juan Formel. He was playing in other popular bands at the time, dance bands, right? But he wanted to hear more than the usual. So this band that he created mixed Afro-Cuban with funk and with other pop music forms. And between 1970 and 1976, the band and the percussionist, and in particular a guy named Jose Luis Quintana, who also is known as Changuito, they developed this rhythm pattern called songo. And in the most simple explanation, I'm going to vocalize it, okay? A typical mambo goes boom, paka, pika, boom, boom, paka, pika, boom, boom, paka. That's the form, right?
Right.
They did this. Boom, paka, pika, boom, 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 paka, tika, boom, taka, pika, boom, boom, paka, tika, boom, right?
Shaking it up.
They made it a lot funkier, and they sort of expanded it out a little bit, and it became incredibly popular.
All right, let's hear some music. What are you going to give us as a first example?
Okay, this is a song later in their career. This is called Anda, Ven y Muévente, but it has all the elements we talked about, the rhythm stuff, but then you can also hear all the great horn lines, and it's very, very progressive lyrics. Check it out.
Los Van Van, not your grandpa's mambo. It's musically innovative. It's very popular with everybody on the island, most people anyway. What's there not to love about that?
The first thing to remember, Marco, is there's nothing about Cuba is easily explained or examined, right? It's like there's very complex emotions, politics, and reality. The second thing is that music can be divided between those that stayed and those that left.
Right.
Now, remember, Los Van Van, they toured extensively around the world, and they were able to become very, very popular, largely because they had the support of the Cuban government, which saw the band going around the world singing the praises of this really magnificent Cuban music, and then sometimes celebrating the virtues of the revolution in the lyrics, okay? Now, this song we're going to hear now is called Canción Urgente para Nicaragua. It's with Silvio Rodriguez, who was a very political singer-songwriter. Remember, the Cuban government was very supportive of the Sandinista government in Nicaragua in the early 80s. And this is a song reflecting that political and emotional and musical support.
And how would you translate this? Urgent song for Nicaragua? Simple as that?
Yeah, an important song, urgent song. Se partió en Nicaragua, otro hierro caliente. Se partió en Nicaragua, otro hierro caliente. Porque el águila daba su señal a la gente, con que el águila daba su señal a la gente. Se partió en Nicaragua, otra soga con cebo. Se partió en Nicaragua, otra soga con cebo, con que el águila daba por el cuello al obrero, con que el águila daba por el cuello al obrero.
So, Felix, Los Van Van going around the world singing the praises of the revolution in Cuba, if they came to the States, I'm guessing that wasn't a very popular thing to do.
You know, in 1999, they did their first tour of the United States, and they saved the last show of the tour for Miami. And, you know, it became so intense that the promoter had to move the venue because the venues didn't want any trouble. I was living in Miami at the time. I was working for NBC, so we sent crews over to cover, and they were very, very large crowds. They were very vocal and sometimes violent. Our crews came back with images and stories of people throwing things at concert goers. They were spitting on people walking into the concerts. The radio stations wouldn't play the band's music. They encouraged people to try to stop the concert. It was really a big deal. But actually, it was really one of the last times it was that big of a deal. I lived there from 98 to 2001, and I saw a lot of change, a lot of easing of the tensions for a variety of reasons, but mostly generational.
In South Florida?
Correct.
Yeah, so what was going on that contributed to the shift in attitudes, do you think?
It was also the influence of the people who had come during the Mariel boat lift. That was between April and October of 1980. 125,000 Cubans left the island from Cuba's Mariel harbor, right? Mm. Castro let those folks go. These are people who grew up with Los Van Van, right? So there's a huge clash in politics and culture and musical taste between the exile community who came here after the revolution in 59 and the people who came during Mariel. These folks were raised on songo and not the classic mambos, cha-cha-chas, and even Cuban son.
So did this musical conflict ever get resolved?
You know, not really, and that's the complexity of talking about Cuba. Everyone is extremely patriotic, all right? Often celebrating the same historic figures like José Martí, the poet who was the father of Cuban independence, where each side sort of interprets his poetry for their own perspective. And the only musician to achieve that kind of equal status on either side was Celia Cruz. She was very, very strongly anti-Castro, but she was so popular, even on the island, that folks gave her a pass for those views. And she still, to this day, is like one of the most revered Cuban musicians of all time. But not so with Los Van Van. There's a very clear line in the sand about this band.
On that note, Felix, I'd like to take us out with a kind of a rare track recorded by Los Van Van with the Brazilian percussionist Carlinhos Brown. This came out a few years back for the HIV/AIDS benefit CDs from the Red Hot organization. A song called Soy Loco Por Ti America, which, you know, kind of tips to those complexities you were talking about in Los Van Van, the band of Castro's Revolution, a band that also loves American culture. So here we go. Felix Contreras, thanks so much for sorting things out with us about Los Van Van.
It was my pleasure, Marco.
Felix Contreras, the host of Alt Latino, a podcast about Latino arts and culture. This week they're doing a deeper dive into Cuban music by looking at those who stayed on the island after the revolution and those who left. Soy loco por ti, America. Voy a traer una mujer playera. Que su nombre sea Marte. Que su nombre sea Marte. Soy loco por ti. De amores, tenga como colores la espuma blanca de Latinoamérica y el cielo como bandera y el cielo como. And that's our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for being with us today.